But I guess that we have many questions from the audience now.
Hi, thank you very much. Those were both fantastic presentations. I learnt a lot, so thank you very much. I suppose I have a question more for Konstantin. And I'm not very good at formulating questions, so I'll just kind of put it together as I speak. But whenever I see the word totalitarianism, I kind of feel a bit uncomfortable because I always think about Slavoj Žižek's, I think it's called Did Someone Say Totalitarianism, and how it's kind of been used to flatten the kind of concept of what was happening in these regions at this time. And it's kind of very much led from the West as well. It's kind of imposed on this region. It's something I've been thinking about a lot over the last few years, because I'm very interested in disrupting this sort of kind of iron curtain concept of, you know, one way or the other. And obviously Hannah Arendt was kind of very much supported by the American anti-communists at that time in kind of internationalizing her kind of concept of totalitarianism. I think it was really interesting what you said about the victim and the kind of victimization and how that's stopped kind of people from seeing the kind of concept of society that exists. And I think it kind of also discredits or undermines what people were able to actually achieve. So I was just interested to hear some of your more thoughts about kind of how this kind of concept of totalitarianism has been really kind of created more in the West and then imposed back on the region from the West. When you're talking about the museums of communism and things like that, it's again playing up often to Western tourists, or this kind of, you know, this self-victimization that's kind of occurred and has created its own problems over the last 30 years as well.
Yeah, so the concept of totalitarianism is what I would call an essentially contested concept. Is very politicized, and there's no consensus over what does it mean. It's an old concept. It was born in the 1920s in Italy. It actually was coined by anti-fascists to refer to the fascists. Then it was appropriated by fascists because they thought it's modern and really expresses their own political spirit. But then fascist Italy was not considered totalitarian anymore because, you know, there was pluralism, a little bit of pluralism in society as compared to Nazi Germany. But then it was extended to Soviet Russia. And then you have a new wave of totalitarian studies in the 50s about Soviet Union. And yes, this is a Western concept used in Western social sciences and politics. In Eastern Europe, it was not used. These socialist states, they never used the word totalitarian to describe themselves. They actually spoke about people's democracies. And so how useful is this concept? As I try to show these cold old models of the 50s, we have to be critical because they don't explain the complexities of these societies. And in that sense, I criticize the debate on totalitarianism in Eastern Europe because they went back to the Cold War models of the 50s. And so we should be more sophisticated than that because there are waves of social history, cultural history, and we should be in tune with those. Is the concept still useful? Some historians say that no. Other, such as Kotkin, for example, he does use the word totalitarianism, but with qualifying adjectives. He speaks, for example, about participatory totalitarianism to show that there was mass mobilization to the totalitarian project. So I think if we use it, we have to redefine it scholarly to go away from this luggage or connotations of the Cold War. And I like David Roberts, for example, who says totalitarianism is a new mode of collective action, and that movements, you can speak about totalitarian movements or about totalitarian regimes. I think there is a distinction between dictatorships who do not have a reigning ideology and totalitarian regimes where you have an ideological project and a drive to transform society according to that project. But again, that is a debate, and I thought that the organizers were very cautious to say we don't want to enter this debate on totalitarianism. So,
Eddie,
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this differentiation that you also introduced in your paper, Constantine, but also in the first kind of panel, that we really make the efforts to differentiate these debates about this concept of socialisms. Okay, but I would like to really get back to that concern, what you put in, Constantine, regarding internationalism that you mentioned at some point. I don't know whether I get the question really like to the point. I would, if we look in the context of East Germany, it was a new nation that was founded on the base of an anti-fascist kind of agreement, anti-fascist, anti-imperialism. And since you are engaged in this comparative kind of analysis, how would you situate that concept of the national in relation to an internationalism, but also how would you situate this in relation to decolonizing processes? If we think of Algeria, if you think of Ghana, if you think then also Senegal, for example, that where the foundation, the idea of a foundation of a nation has been constitutive for also like socialist agendas, not so much Senegal, but I mean specifically Ghana, for example. Can you elaborate a bit how you have been discussed this in these debates, nationalism, internationalism, in relation to also the idea of the foundation of a state, which is different in Hungary, which is different in Poland, which is different in other kind of Eastern European countries. What did you come across to get to this anti-fascist also moment that allows us to discuss this differentiation very specifically, geopolitically speaking? Thank you.
Yeah, so from the beginning of socialism, is the Bolshevik Revolution, there was this debate. Should the socialism be built in one country or should there be a universal revolution? And so formally, this was also the reason of the split between Trotsky and Stalin. There were different views out there. And so the Stalinist view prevailed that socialism should be built within national borders. And so you have Soviet Union. Okay, there was an experiment in federalism. But then after 1945, you have socialism built in nation states who are not annexed to Soviet Union. So we could see also from the example of Soviet Union that building socialism was also an experiment in nation and state building. If you see the Caucasus or Central Asia, they created the socialist nation together with standardization of language, together with collectivization, industrialization. And then you have after 1945 a continuation of nation states, or the creation of federalist states, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, just like the experiment of Soviet Union. And in a way, the failure of socialism led also to the failure of these experiments in federalization, Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. Velvet divorce or bloody divorce like in Yugoslavia. So when socialism collapsed, also certain experiments in state building collapsed. GDR disappeared, the state was dissoluted. It didn't unite with Federal Republic of Germania, but the state dissoluted and only the lands individually joined the Federal Republic of Germany. So there you have nostalgia after communism, but also nostalgia after the lost statehood. There's less nostalgia in Czechoslovakia about the federation, but there is also nostalgia in Yugoslavia, and so you are right. Building socialism was also hand in hand sometimes with state, nation, and state building.
Thank you. I have many, many questions, and for every. I really love when you said that the Kulak was difficult to, it was not visible, it was difficult to see who is Kulak. And I think for the images of this time, it is very, very relevant, because the only images, it is indeed caricature. It is practically impossible to represent a Kulak outside a caricature. Only the caricature can give an image, can visualize this central figure in the society that is a Kulak. I find it very, very interesting. Comment also about the first presentation that we had early in the morning. On how we see with a different presentation, different ways of to enter in this reflection about the society and the link between society and the images. For instance, we had one option that was about to enter through the institutions, and it is a real topic for this 50s to understand the institutional frame and how it evolves. We spoke this morning about centralization, and I think it is a little bit complicated to present the 50s only through the lens of centralization, because in the 50s you have a lot of institutions. It is one feature of this decade to create institutions that lasted only 2-3 years and then they disappeared. The question of the financing is very, who financed what. In the 50s it's really, really complicated to know. For instance, for the exhibition, I don't know who gave the money very concretely. Is it the party? Is it the union? Is it in some countries you have an institution who is dedicated to the financial question? I think it was in Bulgaria when you have an institution outside the artist union. So the institutional landscape in the 50s is very chaotic. So it will be one first entrance. A second entrance, it will be through the career of the artist, so really from the point of view of the artist and how he evolves. So we can include, of course, artists were not born in the 50s, they have a life before that, and that's what we hear this morning with the Czech sculpture and what he did in the 30s, in the 40s, and what you present also about Poland. Here, I would like to ask to every participant, I don't know how to frame it, so I will frame it in a provocative way. I have the feeling that there is something like the persistence of the bourgeoisie inside the socialist. All this, not all, but many of these artists, I think that they keep preserving a bourgeois way of life. You spoke about Aurel Bernhardt. I think it's a very good example of this bourgeois way of considering yourself. And they are quite in the margins when we think of their social positions, in the margins of this new socialist society. Okay, I spoke already a little bit. I think you present a third way of getting into this social history of art, that is the case study with an exhibition. And I find really, really good to take seriously the moment of the exhibition. An exhibition is something, a specific moment, and you show the negotiation, and that is complicated also in this the way works of art were selected and presented. And it was really nice to introduce this history of exhibition as a specific way of dealing with all this question. Yeah, I would like actually have a real question about the typology, because it's a question, a recurrent question for us. My question would be, do we need typology between countries, and what do we do when we present typology? Typologies, of course, you have different typology depending on the topic. You presented collectivization, but if you take another topic, that's another typologies. And it is very often, not to say always, a national typologies. And when we do that, I have the thing that we reinforce this national frame, that we say that obviously the most relevant scale, it is obviously the national scale. But if you think on a regional scale, it is completely different, and something in Romania, in Poland, in Germany can be very comparable. And so it's the role for us of these typologies, and what do we do with that? And when this morning we spoke about the difference between Poland and Czechoslovakia, we are always elaborating spontaneously on really elaborating typologies, and I think we have to be cautious with what we do when we do that, and which scale do we choose? I'm finished.
How to react? So, about this national frame, I mean, this is not my plate, but I should add that all the institutions are national institutions, or almost all of them, like the association, like every kind of institution in the art scene, and that could be one point of view. But on the other hand, even if they are national institutions, everything is about the capital. So everything is happening. I mean, not talking about the social changing in general, but talking about art. So everything happened in the official art in Budapest, in the Hungarian scene. And there was so many effort to spread it all over the country, but it was not successful. So there was just a few amateur circles in big cities. The association, bodies of the association, tried to collect real Stalinist artworks from the countryside and from these smaller, bigger cities, and they were not successful. So it's not just the nationality in the question at the art scene, but this centralized position of the capital, and it. This topic leads to your other question about the bourgeois tendency and all the former attitude in the mind of the artist, like Bernat, Aurel Bernat, who was a very intellectual figure, and he kept this this profile as a very leading important figure during the 50s as well. His best friend was at that time Paul Pazoyi, who had a noble origin, and he was proud of it. He was very famous in the 40s and in the 30s for neoclassical sculptures, and he did the best Rákosi sculpture portrait in Hungary and the best portrait of Rákosi, Mátyás Rákosi. And in this centralized Budapest focused art scene, that could work because they were in the center and they had the power, or they have the intellectual background. And so many hardliners, real communists, had no chance to exhibit because they were too formalist, they were too modernist, not so much. So for us, you need time to understand what's the difference between these languages and voices and styles. So it's many times that could be part of this pre-socialist realist period. But for that point in the 50s, in the early 50s, that was not enough, and these guys were sent to be a member of the party or went to be a bureaucracy, and not to work like as an artist.
Yeah, so following on that idea that socialism was built in nation states, of course, when we discuss experience in socialism building, that's an exercise in comparative history, and you compare case studies in terms of similarities and differences. And of course, it's not only comparison of isolated case studies, we also should look at transfers between these case studies. But one outcome of comparison would be building typologies. Obviously, when you speak about certain topics that are national in character, for example, agrarian legislation or working class labor legislation, so these are confined by the borders of the state. So in that case, you could speak about national typologies. But I do agree with you that in other case studies, there are no national types, and typologies do not help, especially in the world of arts. I think artists circulate. They have the influences they get are very hybrid, so it'd be very difficult to speak about types. You'd probably have to use network theories to see about, you know, you have plurality even within one country or even one city. You have schools, you have styles. I think it still comes a point when you need to classify the diversity. And we saw even today here attempts to classify, you know, socialist realism, either according to chronology, early, middle, end, or even the post-life of it, or according to styles. So yeah, you could create a type of classification that will help them understand diversity, but certainly not rigid typologies and not national types, because that would be misleading.
Thank you very much for both of the presentations, which were really another set of very interesting presentations. I'm all for, and I think that the majority of us here are for studying socialist realism from the second perspective, that is, from the perspective of the everyday life, rather than studying socialist realism as an embodying of totalitarianism, because that has been done for a long time. Yes, I want to. I have a question to Gabor because of that, because you mentioned one very interesting statistics, that is the number of. I want to look at exhibitions, of course, the role of art, the role of institutions, the role of exhibitions, but also the role of the viewer. You said that the All-Hungarian exhibition in the 1950 was visited by 250,000 people, whereas this revisionist exhibition in 1957—I haven't finished yet. Was visited by 70,000. So this is, and you said that 70,000 is already a lot, but 250,000 is obviously even more. So it is, of course, the question is whether the fact, you may of course be suspicious of the number, and perhaps it's not a real number, perhaps it has been, it is a lie, a communist lie, et cetera, et cetera. And so should we look at this mass participation in the communist exhibition as an example of the everyday life, or rather that would be the totalitarianist apparatus, as you have, as one of the authors that you have quoted defined, that totalitarianism is a new mode of collective activity. So is this difference, is this enthusiasm for, supposed, I don't know, real or not, is that an example of totalitarianism, or is it an example of everyday life and the preference for realism idiom over abstract idiom?
That high number for the first socialist realist exhibition was this 250,000 visitors, and there was a firework around this first exhibition. It was published all the time in the press, everywhere. So there was a really huge campaign around this first exhibition, because that was the first time to show something, and it was really a big thing at that time. So that was, the figure was so high. Then it declined, so it became less and less, but still remained very high regarding the recent figures. So right now, in these decades in Hungary, there are certain limits for visitors in museums, and that kind of top level, that was for this contemporary exhibition at that time in the 50s, just can be reachable by Monstre, Van Gogh shows, or Impressionism, or golden treasures of the pyramids, or something like that, and totally not for any kind of contemporary or even post-war art. And that's interesting. What is about the real numbers? I think all the institutions still are very tricky with the numbers because of the supporters, because of the ministry, because you need to show up a better number. So I'm very critical even to these figures and even these socialist figures. But how found the records, they are real numbers. So this is not just a lie. There was a bureaucrat somewhere, and that was the main that we should reach this number. There was always reports about growing the number in the newspapers day by day, week by week. So it's that could be so real number figure as any visitor number could be, I think. And I forgot the other question or what else was it? Yeah. And of course, I think because of this big campaign, it was not about to force them to visit these exhibitions. It was much more about to have an opportunity to visit. I mean, they have a free ticket to the, I mean, country people have free train ticket to get to Budapest and visit the exhibition. That was a chance to visit the capital as well for free. And there are beautiful anecdotes published in the newspapers that peasant people arrive to the exhibition hall and they sit down in the middle of it and open the sandwiches, it was sausage and bread and even some spirit, I don't know, and they had a lunch there in the middle of the Kunsthalle. So I think that's really transformed the social the image of the contemporary art in the very large scale of the society. But I think there is an other thing which is much more important, talking about the big society, and this is not the case of the main exhibitions, but this is the art market. So when there was a so-called fund which organized the nationalized art market, and they opened galleries for sale in every small towns, it started in the mid-50s and it continued in the 60s, and they were still active at the even at the 90s. So they were privatized, and new owners stepped into the space of the former gallery owners. And the artworks exhibited there and sold there, they transformed heavily the aesthetical horizon of the everyday people. So I think that's the most important thing. And it started in the 50s with some etches and graphic design works and continued in the 60s and 70s. And that's why I think that for the normal Hungarians, normal Hungarian people, which are not especially educated in visual art, that kind of the background and the foreground is these aesthetics, official aesthetics of the 60s, because that's when the decoration of all the Hungarian interiors were born. And there are in every flat decoration from that period. So it's not about this very Stalinist period of the 50s, but more this light socialist realist art from the 60s.
Thank you very much. I have a question to Konstantin. You've made this very interesting comparison between the 1950s and 1990s. I think it's convincing in many ways. The 50s as a social economic revolution and the 90s as a counter revolution, kind of liberal conservative undoing of the 50s. And I wonder if you have encountered the notion of capitalist realism built in analogy to socialist realism. And this capitalist realism would be a practice of forming and circulating images, models in general, that were aimed at reconfiguring subjectivities and undoing, let's say, social emancipation. Have you encountered this term? And if yes, what do you think about it? Is it sound or not?
Yeah, so there is this arch over time. This, in a way, speaks of the uniqueness of Central Europe. It's one of the few, probably the only region in the world that transited from capitalism to communism and then back from communism to capitalism. Of course, in many ways, we as historians know that it's an illusion to think that you can go back to a status quo ante, and that's the whole work of historians, to show how this transformation really created new identities, new realities. And if we want to understand society today, we have to study the communist period and not think that we can undo this transformation. And so in the post-communist period, yes, I think this issue was, the undoing the 50s was stronger in countries such as Romania, where the interwar period was considered to be the golden age. And so under communism, there was no de-Stalinization, no reforms. And so they didn't have dissident movement to relate to late communism. So they went back to the interwar period. And so Romanian society after 1990 is kind of a recreation of the interwar period. In other countries, they build more on late socialism, and they didn't go back to the interwar period. Or they go back late. In Hungary nowadays, the interwar period and the Horthy regime becomes a kind of a model, but it was not in the 1990s. I didn't encounter this idea of capitalist realism as a counterpart in art, but it was a problem what to do with socialist realism and how to integrate it into the art history and also into the urban structure of society. So should we remove this art or not? You know, in Statue Park, yeah, in a way it's a good solution, you know, the Hungarian Museum, because everything is preserved and it's in one space and you can visit. On the other hand, it's really quarantined, it's really exiled. It's very difficult to get there. It's actually during winter you can't visit it. So, you know, but of course the point of socialist realism, it is monumental and it's not for private consumption, it's for public consumption. So in a way it dominates the space, so it was mostly removed. No, but it's an interesting idea to follow more on this comparison between the two decades.
Any other questions? There is maybe a moment. So maybe now I will use my powers to have a mic and to chair the session. So let me ask the question, maybe to both of you. But Konstantin, you've mentioned this concept of, which is, as far as I understood, close to your own methodology or research, like l'histoire croisée or the entangled history or the history of transfer. So I'm very interested in how you use this concept while you, for example, researching on social events like this one. Because, and the reason I'm asking this question is that whenever we, because l'histoire croisée, correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea came actually from the comparison of the French and the German situation. So there were both countries which had a kind of similar status in Europe. The moment we are entering the field of Central and Eastern Europe with the dominant countries such as the Soviet Union, this political situation, this political puzzle is completely different than this kind of very simple history of transfer. And I think, for example, because I'm using this concept when I'm researching on the history of exhibitions, because it is a history of cultural transfers in many ways, very complicated, of course, politically dominated by different countries. So probably it's the question to both of you, how actually we are researching on this cultural transfers in a way, and what would be the solution. And I just wanted to sum up probably the story when Dorota this morning showed us the Helenas Berevi painting. This is a kind of, to me, a visualization of this entangled history. So how we deal with that in our part of Europe.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good methodological question. Obviously, we know that these case studies are not isolated. We speak about shared or entangled history. Countries in Central and Eastern Europe are building socialism. They are part of the Soviet sphere of influence. And so we have to go beyond comparison in many ways. And how to do that? Well, I looked in a long-term perspective at modes of internationalism within the socialist universe, so to say. So what modes of international activism were there, you know, in the times of the First International, the Second International, the Third, and also the Third and the Fourth, we know that they were kind of in parallel. So to see what how socialist activists cooperated before the existence of a Bolshevik state, how they met in London or in other cities, and how this cooperation was structured, and what kind of transnational space they opened for cooperation, and how they exchanged publications and ideas. And so, of course, once you have Bolshevik Russia, Soviet Union, Comintern, or Cominform, the rules have changed. So I think we should see, yeah, how exchanges were institutionalized and the dominance of Moscow, but also grassroots level. For example, I'm interested in this idea of intermediaries. Who are the intermediaries between countries, the socialist intermediaries? And so at grassroots level, you can have this experts, Soviet experts, or you can have even working class people who are sent from Soviet Union to these countries. I found the minutes of these meetings with Soviet workers traveling Central and Eastern Europe, or East Europeans traveling too. So intermediaries and exchanges at all levels. And then you see also how these exchanges were institutionalized and what kind of transfers are there. And so the picture then is that of an entangled history with many layers, many networks. Yeah, and so yeah, it depends on the field that you study and the nature of interactions.
I just wanna emphasize the importance of the Soviet model, as I did in my paper, because I saw in many art historians approaches from the early 90s, when first this socialist realist topic came up as something new and interesting and intrigue, and they started to read these old documents. And just for a short moment, and they faced the grotesque nature of this text, and immediately wrote long essays about them. And then I realized, when I dig deeper and deeper, that it could be grotesque and very weird without the Soviet sources. So it's very difficult speaking about this transform. Get more, know more and more and more about the specific movements and happenings in the Soviet socialist realism, because it's a huge, long history. It's very hard to deal with it. It's not like this short period in the art history of the Eastern Europe countries. So it's different. But without it, it's just could be a essay to deal with it.
So I think that we stop here for this morning. Thank you very much to all the speakers and to all the participants. And we meet here. There is lunch served in the workshop room, and we will meet here again at 3 o'clock at 3 o'clock, yeah, with the second set. Not later, as the chair asks everyone.